You're listening to the FQXI podcast. We're starting today's episode with one of the biggest mysteries in science, the origin of life. How do we find the underpinning of biological evolution in the laws of physics? Theoretical physicist and astrobiologist Sarah Imari Walker of Arizona State University has been working on a framework known as assembly theory with her colleagues. Assembly theory aims to quantify the complexity of molecules and objects by assessing the minimal number of steps required to assemble them from fundamental building blocks. Walker spoke to reporter Logan Chipkin about how assembly theory quantifies signatures of life in a way that could be used in space missions to search for extraterrestrial intelligence. She begins by outlining the central question that assembly theory aims to answer.
I think foundationally for me, it's about what life is. So trying to really get to whether we are missing some deep explanation that can account for many of the sort of odd features we associate to life. So there's always been this interesting feature that the laws of physics, you know, life doesn't violate any known laws of physics, but it's not explained by them either. And so when you get to the origins of life or trying to explain living phenomena or why certain things exist on this planet and the sort of complexity that have been generated, it becomes very hard to do with standard physics. And so I've just been really interested in what other kind of principles might be at play. And so one of the things we're trying to do with assembly theory is basically explore that space.
I definitely want to talk about complexity and abundance in a minute, because I know they're very pivotal in assembly theory.
Yes.
But how does assembly theory go about addressing why life is possible, given the laws of nature? And as you say, the presence of life doesn't seem to violate the laws of physics.
Right. So I probably should start with where we start with biosignatures. So in assembly theory, because one of the biggest problems is, how would you recognize that some feature, any feature, you might go out and observe in the world was created by a living process, or you might even say had signatures of design in it, right? So we don't think that the laws of physics contain design. And many of us that are looking for physical explanation for life don't want to necessarily invoke laws that contain design. So evolution obviously is one process where we know we get things like biological bodies and things that seem very complex and seem like they might have been designed, but of course they're evolved, not designed. So there's been this kind of general problem about how would you actually be able to recognize something had to have been evolved and not necessarily could be produced spontaneously. And so that's actually one of the main inroads when we're talking about biosignature detection as sort of a generic signature of life, is just to look for that kind of complexity that you think could only be there through an evolutionary process. The way we formalize that in assembly theory is actually very simple, and I think gets to some of the key points about why the problem is so hard and why assembly theory is kind of a unique way of addressing some of those hard problems. And so the way that we approached it originally, and this is really coming from my collaborator Lee Cronin's lab, because he does these experiments where, you know, he's trying to evolve original life from scratch in the laboratory, and they wanted to have a measure of how would I know that the original life emerged in this chemical system. So he was thinking at the level of molecules, how would I know that it was a product of a living system or not? So the way that it became conceptualized is, if you think of a molecule, so you have some molecule in mind, you know, it's a configuration of a certain number of bonds and things. You can break that molecule apart in terms of its actual structure and then break it apart again and break it apart again and break it apart again until you get to basic elementary building blocks. And the way we treat those in assembly theory when we think about it in molecules is to talk about those as bonds. And then the interesting feature comes when you want to reassemble that molecule, there's a combinatorially large growing number of possible ways to assemble it, depending on how many pieces it has. So you can think about, if I just want to combine those simple building blocks, I can do it by just combining them in pairs, and I can build up that molecule by all of these different pathways. And one of the features of it is that the number of pathways is increasing as the molecule complexity is increasing, but also the shortest path to assemble it is increasing in size. And so this was actually sort of the key insight that Lee had in his lab, was to think about that shortest path as being something that might be observable in the laboratory, but also if that shortest path was sufficiently long and you're looking at this exponentially growing space of possible molecules that might have the same number of elements, the same number of bonds. So a lot of potential for error when you're trying to reassemble that molecule. that could become sort of a life detection metric. So the conjecture of assembly theory is if that shortest path is sufficiently long that you wouldn't expect any random exploratory system, any non-directed, non-selected, non-evolved, non-information processing system would never be able to produce a molecule of a certain assembly path length, minimal path length, because the number of steps to produce it is so high and the space of chemistry around possible molecules in that space is exponentially growing. So this became the idea that assembly theory could capture some kind of complexity threshold above which we would only expect to see living systems. And I'm going to backtrack for a second just to kind of explain, because I think I skipped over something that's kind of important, is just to think about the size of chemical space. So one of the things that's super interesting about thinking about physics of life is that life emerges in chemistry, right? And you can ask questions about, well, why is it that life emerges in chemistry? Most people say there's something about combinatorial possibilities. And I think it's actually that chemistry is the first scale physical reality where the physics of life actually becomes the dominant physics. And what I mean by that is the physics of information. The reason being that even if you think about small molecule chemistry, so things that are just about the size of an amino acid or a dipeptide. So these are very, you know, proteins have hundreds of amino acids and you have hundreds of proteins necessary for your cellular machinery to work. So think of a really simple molecule. There's estimates that around 600 AMU, that there's 10 to 60 possible small molecules, which is a huge number. And certainly it wouldn't be possible to make all of those molecules. So there's something interesting that happens in chemistry that we don't see, say, in fundamental particle physics or in any other scale of reality that physics has operated so far, which is that when you get to chemistry, the number of possible things that could exist is exponentially larger than the number of things that you would ever have the resources in the universe to generate. So people think physical space is large, like physical size of the universe is large. But I like to point out that if you think about the amount of chemistry, then the number of kinds and diversity of molecules that could be made on our planet right now with our technology, I mean, that's a huge number. It's unfathomably large what the size of that potential space is. So life exists in that very large, high combinatorial diversity space, right? We're kind of carving a trajectory through it in the sense that we've selected specific molecules. They're very complex molecules. They're highly improbable because the space is so large. And so what assembly theory is basically trying to quantify is when I see a specific molecule, when I get into that space that's so exponentially large, I shouldn't expect to see it, then that suggests that there had to be some process that knew how to construct that molecule or that was evolved to select for that specific molecule to exist out of. It carries with it this implicit idea that information already exists with knowledge of that specific molecule and how to build it. What Lee's lab did was go into the lab, as they do, and actually take samples from biology and from dead samples and abiotic samples, and even some samples that were blinded provided by NASA. So they didn't know if they were sampled from living things or not. And they figured out a mechanism for, or a way to correlate this shortest path in the assembly space with the fragmentation pattern in mass spec. So you can actually measure with a mass spec device in the lab the assembly of a molecule. And then they were able to demonstrate that the only samples that they had that had produced molecules with an assembly index above 15 were the biological samples. So it seems a sort of conjectured threshold where the exponentially growing space of possibilities is too large for the universe to explore randomly. And then it requires a directed information processing evolutionary process to create those specific things is about 15, at least on planet Earth. So that's where the empirical work started. And what we're doing now is really trying to build that into using this idea of assembly, that molecules are these causal graphs, this way of all these joining operations for making them. And in fact, every object could be considered that way, from people to cars, to planes, to stars, to elementary objects. Could you build a theory of physics that actually accounts for what it is for selection to be operating in this huge space of possibilities and explain why we see the particular features that we do from a more fundamental physics perspective?
It seems that you're groping towards, theoretically, what is the complexity threshold of a molecule, of an entity made of molecules, such that an information-carrying medium would be required to produce such a molecule. Are you sort of thinking in that direction as you move forward with this research? Yeah.
Yes, definitely. And also I should say, even though assembly theory has been validated in molecules experimentally, it's sufficiently general that it should apply to other kinds of structures. So for example, I have a student right now trying to look at assembly of trajectory data. So if you look at a behavior of a physical system. Say it's an oil droplet undergoing Brownian motion, or a living cell that's actually exhibiting goal-directed behavior or some kind of agency. How would you be able to tell a priori the difference that one was based on some kind of information media that was actively propagating information or using information to causally control it versus one that was undergoing some kind of random motion through this possibility space? So I think this idea of assembly theory is actually quite general, and we can apply it to a lot of different ways of thinking about living systems. So one of the ways I think about life is to think about life is, I sometimes say it's the physics of how information structures matter across space and time. And I think that set of words is actually pretty accurate to the physics I mean, except I would replace it with, it's the physics of increasing assembliness if I was going to be more accurate in sort of the mathematics of the theory that's being developed. But I think those two things are the same thing. But part of the challenge is the space that life exists in is super high dimensional. So you can look at life in terms of its physical motion. You can look at it in terms of its chemical complexity. You could look at it in terms of its morphological complexity. You could look at it in terms of language and information processing in this very abstract level. So part of what I see the program of assembly theory moving forward is to show that if you project life down into different kinds of assembly spaces, certain physical systems will look alive in some and not alive in others. And what I mean by that is you've got this high dimensional object of life moving through physical reality in some way. And it's really hard to see that entire structure. I think that's one of the reasons that we've had a hard time with understanding what life is to begin with. So my student that's studying the trajectory stuff keeps giving me the example of a whale that's just moving in a straight line. She's like, how would you know it was a living whale moving in a straight line? I think one of the things is it might look alive in some spaces and not others. And I think this gets to this issue that we've always had, that we think life is a binary categorization of nature. Things are either alive or they're not. And it's much more of a continuum where we have some underlying physics. And sometimes that physics is more apparent than other times. But maybe I'll give one analogy of that last point, because I think it would be helpful, which is we invented the laws of gravitation to understand certain regularities in the physical world, you know, associated with motion, and in particular motion in the presence of massive bodies. And we can study that now in terms of the fact that I'm sitting in my chair, that the planets are moving in particular orbits in the night sky, or studying black holes, or studying large scale galactic structure. But we don't use gravity to study the interior of atoms because it's not really relevant physics. And so part of the conjecture I have about assembly is that it becomes very relevant when you get in these high combinatorial spaces, these very high dimensional spaces, because there's just so many physical possibilities and so many ways to move through those physical possibilities, whether you're talking about the physical shape of an object or its motion. And so the physics of life becomes very apparent when you get into those spaces, but it's not apparent, say, at the scale of elementary particles. And so this is one of the arguments I make about why there could be new physics in life that has previously eluded us, because we just haven't really thought about the physics of what's possible, which is a very constructor theoretic concept, that there's this huge possibility space of things that can happen. But the question is, how do you explain that they do happen? And so I guess I'm kind of on the side of it, of trying to explain the particular features that we observe and why those happened.
Well, it definitely seems that the complexity angle is a very promising one. From what I've read, there was one more element that paired with the complexity in assembly theory when you were measuring the MA of molecules, right? It was abundance, yeah. Is that correct?
Yes, this is actually a critically important feature of the theory, which is I think something that, and I'm glad that you picked up on that, that's cool. It's one of the things that I think other theories of complexity have overlooked in the past. So a lot of people will, for example, critique assembly theory by saying, well, isn't that just the same thing as Kolmogorov complexity, for example, which is a complexity measure that measures the complexity of an output that might be produced in some kind of computation, for example, by the length of the shortest computer program that could produce that output. So the first thing that I would say about why that's different than what we're doing in assembly theory is in Kolmogorov complexity, you're talking about a program that's describing the output. And what we're talking about in assembly theory is supposed to be an intrinsic feature of the object you observe. It's actually an observable. You can go in the lab, at least for molecules, and measure the assembly index directly. So it's not about a program description length. It's supposed to be a physical attribute of a molecule in the same sense that you might talk about its elemental composition or its mass, but it's just a feature that's part of the causal structure of that molecule in terms of what's the minimal history for the universe to produce that object. So that's one key difference. But the second key difference is, which is implicit in molecular assembly because of the measuring apparatus, is this issue of abundance. Because one of the things that we say is, if you're talking about the assembliness of an object, it's a combination of the assembly index plus the abundance of that object. And that's already implicit when we go into the lab and measure assembly with mass spec, because a mass spec actually won't measure, it can't detect molecules unless you have at least 10,000 copies of them. So this actually gets into a really important concept, which is the concept of the reliability of the process to produce that particular molecule. If something's complex and it can be reliably produced by the universe in the sense that you can have multiple copies of that complex object, it wasn't just a random statistical fluke that occurred once in the entire history of the universe and can't be produced again, then that seems to be suggestive that you actually have another physical system that has made that process reliable, that actually has knowledge about how to construct that particular object. So this abundance argument is actually really key to saying that there had to be some constructors, or there had to be some information processing systems as part of the causal chain of events in the universe for producing that particular object, because it really gets into this reliability argument that it wasn't a one-off statistical fluke of the laws of physics, but it actually is something where there is a physical system that constructs it. So yes, that's a really distinguishing feature of assembly theory. And I think one of the reasons that it has some potential deep connections to what's happening in constructor theory and some of the ideas there.
Yeah, the abundance angle definitely makes sense, because as you were saying, unlikely though it might be, some very complex molecule could appear and it could have a signature or whatever. But if we're interested in life, then almost by definition, life is propagating over many generations, in part because it's robust. Yeah.
I think there's this kind of notion that comes from quantum physics that things can just statistically fluctuate out of the vacuum, right? So we even have this idea of like Boltzmann brains, that like a brain can just spontaneously fluctuate into existence without an evolutionary process. And actually the current sort of theory is actually demonstrating this feature that because of these causal constraints in the assembly space, the fact that in order to assemble an object, you have to have a reliable process, and there's this whole causal chain of events that constrains what can happen, you don't get things randomly statistically fluctuating into existence from just the space of possible things. They have to be causally connected to what came before. And so a simple example of that I can give is, I would never expect a single human to ever exist anywhere in the universe, just one human being, right? We're a population, and we're a distribution of very closely related things that exist that share a common causal history. And you can actually formalize and quantify that intuition that you actually need the evolutionary process to assemble a distribution of objects with similar properties in assembly theory precisely. So I think there's a lot of promise for thinking about the fact that causation is actually becoming maybe a fundamental concept in physics in this theory, in the sense that in order to get certain configurations of matter, you had to have already in place the causal structure of the history to create those specific things. So not any arbitrary history of stochastic fluctuations between things is possible, but it actually has to have this causal contingency.
I see. So then abundance and complexity in assembly theory aren't necessarily independent.
No, they're not. I think about it a little bit like, you know, the temperature and pressure of a gas. So you can think of an assembly index as basically a measure of time. So it's actually like ordering of events. So how many, what's the minimal number of events that had to happen to assemble a particular object? So it kind of tells you how long the universe has had to exist, or how long a causal process has had to be going for that particular object to exist. And the way I think about it fundamentally is actually to say that one thing that physics has been missing is, we think about objects as existing in the three dimensions of space, but we don't actually think of them as having an extent in time. And assembly theory for me is saying that objects actually physically exist in time. They exist across time, and you need a certain amount of time to hold certain objects. So unless the universe had proceeded for a certain number of ordered events, you won't see certain structures emerge. So the assembly index is in some sense kind of partially ordering things that can exist by their assembly index, and saying that you can't have certain things exist until some other things have existed. And the abundance is an additional causal constraint, which tells you something about the structure. We call it a causal cone in assembly theory, but basically what's the structure of the relationship between the objects that you have as you look back in the past. So what's the structure of their co-assembly space and the particular trajectories that could have created them together, but also what kind of constraints do they place on what can be generated in the future? I think that idea is very important, but the abundance gives you a really good metric for quantifying certain features of that particular structure across time.
So I'm glad you brought time up. This is very interesting. Is it fair to say that, so you rank a bunch of chemicals based on the MA scale? Part of the theory is that basically molecules of a certain index require a certain amount of, let's say, cosmological time before they can evolve. So is it fair to say that you could look back in time through telescopes, and if you observed certain molecules with certain indices, would that render the theory problematic?
I think not necessarily at the scale of molecules. Well, it depends on the size. So even in the theory, we make a distinction for biosignature science. That's a real technical distinction that's useful even for thinking about flying NASA missions, like what would be the technical criteria for saying this is produced by biology. But philosophically, you could apply the same concept at some kind of boundary of technology. So we think there's some molecules that might require a 4 billion year history of evolution, like on our planet, to evolve a technological civilization that can then, say, automate chemistry with AI and then invent new molecules that the universe has never seen before. So maybe if you saw one of those, it might, very early in the universe, it might break it. But I don't think the kind of molecules that we see, you know, at the biosignature boundary, it would be difficult to relate the number of steps in assembly theory to cosmological time, but I don't think that it would be a lot of cosmological time to produce those. I think the issue is also, what's the set of causal constraints? So there's an observational problem, which is seeing molecules that early in the history would be very problematic observationally. There's a technical issue, which is, I think the emergence of life has to happen on planets for a reason, and you need a certain density in an assembly space of sort of co-constraints in the causal structure of the assembly space in order to nucleate the transition to life. And that's sort of where this gets into a theory for how the origin life transition happens. So I guess my short answer is, in principle, yes, it could break the theory and that could be a test against it. But I think exactly as you posed it, I don't think it could work. I think if I was going to take your idea and actually use it, I would say if I saw something like a Dyson sphere, like a technological object with very, very, very high assembly in the very earliest part of the universe, and it didn't, you know, there was no planet in its history or anything like that, then I think it might break assembly theory. Because basically what assembly theory is saying is there had to be a particular causal chain of events in order to assemble things like molecules or people or the kind of technological artifacts on our planet now. I would be trying to look for early signs of technology because they're observationally easier to potentially detect in the early universe, and also because their minimal assembly path length is much longer. So they would be even less probable of seeing early.
It just sounds like no, that it would be very difficult to render assembly theory problematic by just trying to find certain very complex molecules in the distant past, or at least it would be problematic for kind of deeper reasons, and it would throw a lot of our other scientific explanations into question. Is that fair?
Yes. I do want to emphasize that what we're doing with assembly is a falsifiable theory, right? So I think your more general question is, if we found a high assembly molecule under a situation that we would we could rule out the possibility of life being part of the explanation, then that would be something that could break the theory.
Sticking to time, did you think at all about the physics of irreversibility as you were thinking about the steps required to create a complex entity?
Yes. So something that we debated a lot, which was actually just something, it was like more people kept wanting to introduce this, but it wasn't supposed to be a feature of the theory. Because we always take, if you think about assembly theory and molecules, you take the molecule apart and you break it down and you assume only a forward process for building up. So we don't have any steps that are irreversible. And there are really important reasons for that. And they're based on physical motivation. So I remember for years, I was having a debate with a postdoc about adding those kind of processes because he thought mathematically they should be there, but also mathematically they lead to divergences because you could have infinite path lengths then in an assembly space. If you could just have things breaking up and breaking down, then some things could just take infinite time to produce something. And that's actually mathematically not pretty, but it's physically inconsistent with some of the core principles of assembly theory. And so the sort of real foundation of assembly theory is it's much more like how people talk about causal set theories of quantum gravity than any other theory that I found in physics so far. And the premise is that time itself is actually fundamental. And so the ordering of events in causal set theories of quantum gravity is what's fundamental. So you have events can combine to make other events. In assembly theory, we say things that exist can combine to make other things. But when you actually look at an object in assembly theory, the way I think about it is that object is its assembly space. So there's no sense of reversibility in the pathways because the structure is only one of assembling the universe. It's like the forward process of how does the universe move forward in time, because time has a directionality and time is fundamental. Now, of course, then all objects have this kind of forward assembly process that's part of their causal structure as they become embedded in time. But it doesn't mean that when you actually look at the emergent dynamics on top of that, that you can't have irreversibility. And so what I mean by that is, of course, it's the case that I might have a process that can assemble a specific object and then another process that could disassemble that same object. And I think this then gets into some concepts that I know Chiara Merletto has been working on quite a bit lately in constructor theory about, you know, if you're talking about an irreversible process or a reversible process, it really comes down to, do the constructors exist to cause those transformations to happen? Something can be reversible if it has a constructor for the forward direction and one for the backward direction, and they may not necessarily be the same constructor. There's kind of a similar sort of way of thinking about it in assembly theory, which is objects can be assembled if there's a system that knows how to assemble them. And we always order those objects in time by their assembly index. But you could also have something that could disassemble them, and they may or may not be the same information processing systems or constructors or however you want to talk about it. But the key point is that the underlying foundations is that the universe is always moving forward in time. So as a function of time, there are more and more things that could be generated, but they're not always necessarily generated. And there's some irreversibility to that process because you don't always have the things that exist that could disassemble all the stuff in existence. So I ask this question a lot with the biosphere, for example. You know, the biosphere has been constructed over a 4 billion year history. And it seems like that's a relatively irreversible process because we've built up the constructor that basically makes the biosphere increase in complexity, but there's not natural system that would just wipe out everything of life on the planet. I mean, there's a lot of hypotheticals that we might cite, but it's actually really hard to set our biosphere to state time zero. It doesn't seem like it's a very likely process, although it can happen potentially.
Right. What I find interesting about assembly theory is that it definitely seems to, and you alluded to this, it seems to take seriously the fact that there is a directionality to the universe, at least at the level of assembly theory, to be clear.
Yes. No, it is a core feature of how we're building the theory, that the universe has a directionality to it. And some of the features of that directionality are actually directly associated with the assembly index. So I think things become, in some sense, more irreversible the higher assembly the objects are. Actually, this is one of the reasons that I can account for in assembly theory. If you're inventing a new theory of physics, you want it to work the way current theories of physics work in the domains where they're applied, right? And so one of the issues we always have with saying time has a directionality to it is that when we look at elementary particles and things, they seem to not have a directionality. And so how I think about that is, if you sort of think about processes in terms of their assembly index, elementary particles are the lowest assembly objects in the universe. They have no causal structure. They don't exist in time. They're instantaneous objects, which is one of the reasons that their dynamics are easy to reverse in time and why the equations describing them basically have this reversibility property. But when you get to things like us, we're objects that are highly embedded in time. My colleague, Michael Lockman, will say he's 4 billion years old. What he means is he's a 4 billion year pattern of information that has propagated as part of our biosphere. But how I account for that in assembly theory is to actually think about that physical structure as being extended that far in time. And when you get up to objects like us, the combinatorial space of things is growing with the assembly index. So every time that you're increasing the assembliness of a system, you're also decreasing the ability to reverse the path the way it came, because there's more and more paths possible through that space. So things like you and I are much more, we're very irreversible in terms of, if you wanted to rewind it, there's just too many paths of possibilities because the assembly index is so high. But for elementary objects, they're completely reversible because they have no assembly associated to them.
And have you given any thought to the maximum possible, let's say, increase in assembly index over time or over generations of the underlying information carrying medium, or not really?
No, I have thought about it. So I think a lot of the conceptual foundations in assembly theory are in place, but actually writing the papers to get these ideas formalized is a much longer process. So we're in the very early stages of that. And the first real theory paper, as I mentioned, is going to be coming out this spring. But one of the things I'm talking about with some of the students and postdocs I work with is exactly that question. If you were building a system that you had specific assembly of the inputs and assembly of the outputs, what would be sort of, if you want to think about that as almost like an engine for increasing assembliness, what would be sort of the thermodynamic properties of that kind of system? And what kinds of constraints could you have exactly, as you say, on the information media that would be necessary to have that kind of change in assembly index happen? And how does that relate to the change in the assembly index? So we do have ways that we're thinking about trying to formalize that. And really, I should say, just as the visualization of it, when you go from a low assembly object to a higher assembly object, you're looking at an object that exists in a combinatorial space for the low assembly object, that the one with the higher assembly, the combinatorial space is exponentially larger. So you're increasing the specificity. I mean, this is one of the things that assembly theory is supposed to be capturing. The amount of information in that object relative to all the other things that could exist is increasing. And so presumably what we want to do in formalizing that kind of thing is actually looking at the sets of possibilities for assembling something with low assembly versus high assembly, and how that increasing specificity, that increasing selectivity among the set of possible things actually influences some of the ways that we can talk about information media or work or thermodynamic cycles and those kind of things.
Sounds like there's a lot of exciting research coming down the pipeline.
Yeah. But, I'm excited.
Yeah.
Well, but I think the important thing, which Lee is always harping on me about, which is it has to be testable. And I'm like, I know. So I think one of the things that we're doing that's super important, like I'm talking about building this engine thing, but of course it has to be mapped to an experiment and it has to help us inform this origin life problem ultimately for the research program we're undergoing.
Sure. So on that note, have you presented this to scientists who are actively looking for signs of life elsewhere in the universe? Is assembly theory mature enough that you can present it to them and they can then apply it to data that they capture from?
Yes. Yeah. So absolutely. I don't think I'm really supposed to talk details, but I am speaking with some people working on mission proposals about the possibility of flying assembly theory and upcoming NASA missions. It is within the realm of possibilities. One of the issues is that the mass spec in Lee's lab is what's called an Orbitrap. And I'm by no means an expert in the experimental part or mass spec or anything, but it's one of the highest resolution mass spec instruments that you can get. And it's huge. And it's not possible to fly something at that resolution on a NASA mission. But I do have a student from my lab, John Malloy, that was in Glasgow for 6 months this year, working on the problem of what would be sort of the minimal resolution on a mass spec to be able to detect high assembly objects. And so we have made a lot of progress in that domain. So basically, the short answer is yes. It's not a conceptual limitation to be able to already fly assembly theory as a life detection proposal on a mission in the solar system that uses mass spec. But we do have some technical hurdles to get over to try to say with what confidence, based on the resolution of the mass spec, we've actually detected a high assembly molecule.
And are you allowed to talk about the technical limitations or not at all?
Oh, no, I can definitely talk about, yeah, that's fine. I think the main issue is just what is the mass resolution on your mass spec? So if you actually have your mass spec and your resolution is, I don't know, 100 AMU versus 10 AMU, then you have a different potential distribution of molecules you might have detected in your sample. And then the question becomes one of, did you detect, you know, what's the likelihood of there being a high assembly molecule in there or not? And I think we'll be able to do it with reasonable confidence on the instrumentation that the resolutions of the instrumentation that NASA has used already, but it might turn out to be the case. And this is where we are right now with the data analysis and things that we're doing. It might be the case that we actually have to recommend that there are slightly more sensitive mass spec. It actually tends to be the case that most of the mass spec flown are only sensitive to measure low molecular weight molecules. And it might be that it's just too low to actually pick up high assembly molecules. So that's sort of where some of the debate about the detection issue is. So it might be that we have to suggest different instrumentation, but I don't think it'll be too far off from what's flown now.
Okay, well, that's also another very exciting development. So I want to finish off with this question. So moving forward with assembly theory, what's the most fundamental question that you're hoping you'll be able to answer about the physics of life or the nature of life in its relation to the universe using assembly theory?
Yeah. So my question, like early in my career, I was very interested in this idea of top-down causation and whether information could actually be a causal variable in a theory of physics. And I think I've come around to the fact that I don't think any of that works because, not because it's a problem with the conceptual foundations of those, well, it's a problem with the conceptual foundations of those sets of ideas, but not the motivation for those ideas themselves, right? So people have a lot of issues with the fact that there's no room for higher level causation, doesn't seem like there's any room for free will, minds can't matter to matter, like all these kinds of discussions people have. And it's all because they're not allowed by Newtonian physics, or the way that we've cast physics for the last 300 years, which is always cast in terms of an initial condition and some fixed dynamical law, which was one of the reasons I got really enthusiastic about constructor theory, because they were really trying to propose something different. And they had a natural way of talking about information where it didn't look like information was magic. Information was basically just causal constraints on certain kinds of physical processes. And this idea that information is something that can be copied between physical media and retain its properties, I think is a very natural description. And so I guess the reason I'm bringing up all of this is then I started working on assembly theory, which I got excited about because it did have this observable that we can measure in the lab, and because it's coming from understanding the structure of chemistry, but from a more fundamental physics type of perspective. And because it has this foundation in thinking about the causal structure of objects, it has a lot of room for thinking in new ways about these kind of concepts. And so I guess for me, longer term, by thinking about objects as things that exist in time in a complex way via the structure of their assembly space, I think there are more natural ways of talking about what information is as a physical thing that's no longer abstract. And what I mean by that is I think that information is just what the world looks like to us when we're looking at time as a physical dimension. And so it's easy for me to see that in the structure of assembly spaces in terms of the fact that when you look at a molecule, you just see the molecule. But what assembly theory is saying is that the molecule is actually this giant causal graph of all the possibilities of assembling the molecule, which we can directly measure with this assembly index, that one sort of projection of that graph. And if I think about all of us as these giant assembly spaces, we're interacting across time via the structure of our assembly spaces in very complex ways. And if you want to ask questions like, why is it that I can have a conversation with you right now and you understand the words I'm saying and they seem very abstract and like they can move through physical media in a way that seems very perplexing, the answer in assembly theory would be that there is a very deep structure in the co-assembly space where those objects are actually overlapping. And so to me, that becomes incredibly promising because I've always been perplexed my entire career about why information seems to have these very abstract properties. And I think that there's some hope in assembly theory of actually addressing them. Similar one with mathematics. I mean, mathematics to me looks like a kind of information. It's why it works so well at describing the physical world. We write down mathematical laws and we can copy them between physical media really well and they retain their property of describing the same kind of regularities in the physical world. It seems to be that mathematics is the most accurate kind of information to be copied. And so I guess I have some hope that assembly theory might help us understand where that exists in a material way, which is super fascinating to me.
Thank you to Sarah Imari Walker for chatting to Logan Chipkin there. The fascinating conversation extended way beyond the edited version that you just heard. So head to our website, qspace.fqxi.org/podcast. That's qspace.fqxi.org/podcast to hear the extended version of that conversation. Walker is a fascinating speaker, and she went on to explain how life versus non-life may not be a binary categorization, but perhaps more of a continuum, and how that can complicate issues with understanding the origin of life. We have links to these and to more articles, podcast interviews, and conference talks with Walker on the QSpace podcast page. You can also find bonus material from other episodes of this podcast on the site that we don't always release through your podcatcher or on YouTube. I'm also going to add a link to FQXI's donation page. FQXI is a non-profit organisation, and these podcast episodes are only possible thanks to your support. And crucially, your donations also go towards funding research, such as Walker's, into foundational questions about life, consciousness, physics, and the nature of reality. Since her chat with Chipkin was recorded, Walker and colleagues have published more on the topic, and I'll be linking to their papers too, including a paper published last year in the journal Nature.